Kuat, Coruscant, Wedge began. Sluisvan, Thyfera, any number of places, but shipyards, Jag said.
Zek frowned. How do you know?
Wedge had noticed that Zek frowned just about every time Jag spoke, and Jag frowned just about every time Zek spoke.
The pattern of the last several days' worth of Confederation attacks and raids, Wedge said. Mostly against orbital shipbuilding facilities. Their clear strategy is to diminish the Alliance's production and repair of warships. That way, despite the fact that the Confederation has fewer worlds than the Alliance, by orders of magnitude, they'll come closer to parity in shipbuilding resources.
Which sounds, Jag interrupted, as though they have a pretty clear military plan in place. I wonder why they need a supreme military commander if they're already cooperating so well.
That cooperation won't last without a commander they all agree on, Leia said.
Now, back to Alima.
Wedge smiled.
Sorry.
Jaina turned her tabletop display so everyone could see it. On it was the triangular plan of one entire Star Destroyer's deck level. We've added the last several days' worth of Errant Venture security recordings to our sample, and Booster authorized the ship's computers to give their analysis top priority, and gave us a more complete set of deck plans to compare them with. We can confirm a pattern of Alima's movements.
She began tapping the screen, and each time she did so, a different level was displayed.
Here, for example, casinos and shopping. Thin traces widely spread. She was searching, and not finding anything.
She tapped again.
A few casinos where she spent a lot of time. I don't think she's a gambler or attempting to build a new social life. Levin shows up a lot in the holocam views during Alima's presence, so it's likely she's keeping tabs on her partner.
Alima was thrilled. Only half an hour ago, she detected the Force presence, the one that said Leia was probably aboard again.
You were right, she told Levin.
She donned her black hooded cloak and felt around with her one functioning hand to be sure that all her weapons and tools were readily available.
I usually am,
Levin said. She got up from the bed, moved to the compartment's tiny closet, and selected a dress jacket that was all piratical purple synth silk and big gold-toned buttons.
I think I'll get some gambling in while you're out killing people. Hey, the deal is still the deal, right? You set eyes on either of the Solos, and I've met the terms of our contract.
Of course,
Alima assured her.
Zyost.
Ben, save girl. Ben, protect girl.
I have to get her off world,
Ben murmured in his sleep.
I need a ship.
Ship. Ben, ship. Learn ship. Ben, learn ship.
I already know how to pilot a ship,
Ben protested. He struggled against the hold sleep had on him, but something reminded him he mustn't move right now. If he moved, he would...
what? Fall down.
Learn ship.
The voice was unusually emphatic, and in Ben's mind, a picture appeared. The image of a ball-shaped craft. It was odd and organic, with a rough red surface texture. In the center of the sphere facing him was a transparent hatch or canopy. Red spars stretched upward and downward from the craft. They seemed articulated, insectile. But this vehicle was no living thing, not like a Yuuzhan Vong craft. Ben sensed it was machinery, but machinery that was aware of him, waiting for him. He woke up with sunlight, broken up by branches above, streaming into his face. And he knew where the red ship was. Or rather, he knew the direction to take to find it, if it was real. The TIE fighter did not find them at noon. That was because Ben snipped the long leg of the tracking device in his pouch, assuming that it was the unit's antenna. He must have been right. Starting an hour and a half beforehand, and waiting until some time past noon, he, Kiara, and Shaker rested in a small ravine, a place where infrared traces would be harder to detect from any angle but straight up. He distantly felt the eye in the sky, but it did not come near him. If he ever needed to, he could reattach the antenna.
Coruscant System, Errant Venture.
In one of the ship's great lobbies, where lights were bright and visitors mingled well away from the expensive attractions of casinos and shops, but not far from the expensive attractions of several surrounding bars, Alima spent a few minutes in a data kiosk, downloading the last several lists of new arrivals. Of course, not everyone who came to Errant Venture consented to be listed, but many did, so that an automated search code would detect their names and announce their arrival to friends. She had scanned through several hundred names, recognizing none, when she felt a flicker in the Force. Then it was more than a flicker. It was a light, a signal. She looked toward its source. Entering the grand lobby was a human male, unusually tall, light-skinned, his long black hair tied back in a ponytail. He wore dressy civilian clothes, black slacks and boots, a dark blue tunic with yellow striping angled across the chest, a black vest and belt. Alima knew him at once. He had once been a joiner, had once belonged to a Killick nest. He was Zek. She drifted toward him when she became aware of another presence, this one much closer. She turned her head to see a thick-chested man with a trim, graying beard and startling green eyes. He stood 2 meters from her, staring at her, smiling. He wore Jedi robes.
Horn, she said.
I'll say this once, Corrin said. Give up now.
She raised her blowgun and fired. Horn plucked the dart from the air. He opened a datapad, dropped the dart onto the screen, and snapped the device closed. That gave Alima time to ignite her lightsaber. Corrin drew and followed suit, his silver blade contrasting sharply with her blue-black blade. Alima became aware of applause. Corrin, too, glanced around, not moving his head. Patrons of the Errant Venture were drawing back from their standoff, but not very far. Many were clapping. Some were putting down bets. Alima saw Corrin silently offer a curse at their stupidity. And now Zek was moving toward the two of them, his lightsaber held in hand. This was a trap, and Alima cursed her own stupidity. Alima turned and ran as fast as her crippled foot and damaged body could manage. Alima reached the exit and whipped around the corner, pausing for a moment to retrieve her blowgun from under her left arm and reload it. The broad corridor where she found herself was well lit, and the panic from inside the lobby had not yet infected the streams of pedestrian traffic here, so she was quick to notice the figure in the distance ahead of her, running toward her with unusual speed and purpose. It was Leia. Leia Solo, looking straight at her. Alima could feel a flash of anger from her through the Force. It was echoed by a similar flash from behind, down the hallway, in another direction. Alima grimaced. This wasn't right. Han should be here. Alima would kill Han. Leia would suffer. Alima would escape. But now, with two Jedi behind her, and one in either escape direction, Alima would have to be instantly, lethally efficient if she was to get away. Getting away was the most important thing at this moment. She would have to abandon justice in favor of practicality. She would have to kill Leia. Alima raised her blowgun to her lips. Leia raised one hand. Alima felt the blowgun twitch, and the dart within it shot backward, straight into her mouth. Alima froze there for one long, terrible moment. But she wasn't dead. The poisoned tip had not come down on her tongue. With infinite care, Alima turned her head to one side and spat the dart out. Then, as cold fear clawed at her heart, she ran. Minutes later, Alima was in a cargo hold, hurtling between tall, lashed-together stacks of plasteel containers, continuing to move as fast as she could, certain that pursuing Jedi were just an instant behind her. They had to be using the ship's holocamp system. Alima didn't understand. She thought that her techniques would defeat it. The enemy must have new techniques. A door in the bulkhead ahead of her hissed open, and a man stepped through. He wore a full-coverage garment of glistening blue material and a helmet, narrower and closer than a pilot's. Its faceplate was transparent, and through it she recognized the features of Jagged Fell. He extended an empty hand. "Alima, surrender. I guarantee..." She raised her blowgun and shot him. He pitched forward. No, he knelt forward. He was drawing his holstered blaster before she'd realized he wasn't dead, wasn't dying. Armor. He had to be wearing armor. He raised his blaster and shot her. The blast struck her in the left shoulder, spinning her around, throwing her to the ground. Pain lanced through her. Pain and the realization that he'd broken her clavicle, that he'd further mutilated her. She rolled to one side as he shot again. The blast missed her. She lashed out at him through the force, sweeping him aside, hurling him deep into a mass of cargo crates. The wall of crates, held together by tough webbing, folded in on itself as if devouring Jag. She got up and ran, staggering worse than ever through the doorway by which Jag had entered. Leia was the first of the pursuers to reach the hangar bay used by the Errant Venture customers who had rented compartments for more than a day. The main doors in the floor were open, and a shabby YV-666 light freighter was sinking through them into space. Alima Rar was in the cockpit. Leia exchanged looks, promising mayhem or death with her for a second, and then the transport was out of sight.
She stole my ship!
Levin clamped her head between her hands as if trying to prevent an explosion. She spun around as if seeking some corner of her small stateroom where she could find refuge from the truth.
My ship!
Han glanced at Leia and shrugged.
Actually, she's taking it better than I expected.
Leia awkwardly patted the captain's shoulder.
I know you must have loved your ship.
Levin was abruptly still.
Actually, I hated her, but she was still worth something.
She shrugged.
Oh, well, I have another one coming.
Speaking of what you have coming,
Han produced a data card and held it before her. She reached for it, but he kept it out of her grasp, and now she eyed him suspiciously.
What is it?
The location of the Confederation meeting you told me about, Han said. Place and time.
Levin's eyes gleamed.
So give it over. I met the terms of our contract.
Leia shook her head, smiling with just a little bit of malice.
That was no contract. You made requests, remember? True.
Levin didn't look too disappointed.
But you obtained and brought the information, so it must be on the table.
It is, Han said. But among other things, we want to know what it's for. It cost me a lot of favors to get.
Oh.
Levin considered and looked between them.
I'm going to give it to a man, for a ship, and to clear me out of his life, out of his consideration.
Is he likely to turn it over to the Galactic Alliance government? Leia asked. Levin nodded instantly.
I'd put the likelihood at about 100%.
Leia said.
I don't think we can,
but Han handed Levin the card. Leia finished smoothly.
Protest too much after all the help you gave us.
She shot Han a bewildered look.
Are we done here?
I think so.
Han gave Levin a professional, pleasant smile and led Leia to the door.
Try to stay out of trouble.
Soon.
Levin said.
Nice meeting you at last.
Out in the corridor, Leia said,
All right, I'm completely confused. As much as you've supported the Corellian cause...
Why have I suddenly turned traitor?
Han finished.
Sweetheart, I didn't have as much trouble as I should have had getting that information. Which means one of two things. Either security's not what it should be for that meeting, meaning the Galactic Alliance will have it soon anyway, meaning all I've done is to give her a couple of days' head start in getting the information to them. Or there's a lot of disinformation out there, meaning that everybody who gets deep enough is getting a different wrong answer. If it's the first one, then Levent gets her reward from her government contact. No loss to me or Corellia. If it's the second one, Levent and her government contact will wander into a trap. Probably a Durgegen trap set up for us.
Zyost.
This set of ruins was no heap of rubble, which was good, since Ben wasn't sure he could reach the next place on the map. He had been 3 days without food. Kyera won. Shaker was down to draining energy from the various batteries Ben had brought from Faskus's camp. Of them, he retained only a partial charge in the primary blaster pistol. The data pads didn't count. Their batteries didn't contain enough energy to permit an R2 unit to walk 4 steps. But this set of ruins, it clustered high on a mountain ridge, built just below a cliffside hundreds of meters tall. The cliff looked like a portion of the mountain had been sliced away by a giant lightsaber millions of years in the past, leaving the stone to weather until some species decided to build a citadel here. Not some species, the original Sith species. The citadel was made of black and mottled gray stone and looked large enough to house 1,000 people. But no one lived there now, Ben thought, not that he could be sure. He detected little flickers of life through the Force, but those impressions were always washed away by the flow of dark side energy that emanated from the place. Like the planet itself, the Citadel was suffused in such energy, but more so. Still, the voices were pleased that he was here. He heard them even when he was awake now, and when he dreamed, they taught him how to fly the eye-shaped craft they had shown him.
Coruscant, Senate Building, Admiral Nyathol's office.
Nyathol answered the beep with a gravelly command.
Come in!
Jason Solo entered, dressed in his immaculate black guard uniform and a flowing black cloak. He gave her a crisp salute. Admiral? Nyathol returned it.
Sit! Hurry! I have a meeting in 30 minutes.
Jason sat. Galadar.
I don't understand.
Probably because I hurried. Galadar 8 is where the Confederation meeting is going to take place. The election of your counterpart, their supreme military commander, and the launch point of their next fleet action. Nyathol sat up straighter.
Intelligence has been working on this all this time, and you come up with an answer first?
I have sources distinct from intelligence's.
Such as your parents?
Nyathol didn't miss the slight frown that crossed Jason's features. My parents had nothing to do with obtaining this information. It's from another smuggling resource I've been cultivating for months.
Interesting. When?
2 weeks. Actually, 13 standard days. Nearly exactly. Nyathol made an exasperated noise.
It will take that long at least to put together a coordinated response. We're going to rush into our counterplan and get good people killed as a consequence.
If I may. Jason drew a data card from a pocket and set it on the desk before Nyathol. I've taken the liberty of putting together a proposal. For a response you would probably consider uncoordinated, but it would get forces there fast and possibly undetected. And I doubt our equally uncoordinated enemy will anticipate it. Nyathol gave him a dubious look and inserted the card into her desk slot. Jason's plan was simple and unconventional. Galadar was an undistinguished mid-rim star, not far from Ancien. Not one of its worlds was habitable for most of the galaxy's sapient species. The planet Galadar 8 was a gas giant, a world whose surface was a beautiful, glowing swirl of mottled reds, oranges, and yellows. At one point in the distant past, it had been a favorite vacation spot for the Old Republic, circled by a ring of resort satellites from which patrons could marvel at its natural beauty. But taste changed, and the brief era in which planetary artistic appreciation could serve as the be-all and end-all of a wealthy family's vacation ended. And with it, the years of usefulness of the Galadar system. The last resort satellite had gone out of business a century and a half ago, and Jason's estimation was that the resort would probably be the site of the meeting to come. Step one of his plan was to send Jedi-piloted Stealth X snub fighters into the system, giving the Alliance military information about the Confederation forces already there, particularly sensor platforms. Step two involved bringing in forces selected from fleets and task forces already in that area of the galaxy, choosing them carefully to keep any one unit from losing too much strength and defeating the ability of spies and analysts to determine where those reassigned craft were going. Step three had Jedi observers directing Alliance forces into the system, avoiding sensor observation or scouting patrols, and setting them up within the atmosphere of Galadar 8. The glowing, radiant atmosphere was so thin at its upper reaches, barely denser than the empty space in a standard solar system, that vehicles and vessels of all varieties could be stationed there. Such a world tended to emit higher levels of electromagnetic radiation, making communication between vehicles more difficult, but also making detection more difficult. Step 3 would continue until the mission commander concluded that it was no longer possible to sneak forces into the atmosphere of Galater 8. And even then, larger capital ships could muster at a point outside the system and be ready to jump in. In Step 4, the Stealth X observers would signal when the meeting had begun, and all the Alliance forces would move in against the Confederation forces. Nyathol and her analysts evaluated Jason's plan, and over the span of a day, considered and discarded several others. Eventually, they settled on Jason's. It would have to be modified and detailed, but it would serve as a template. At their next meeting, Nyathol informed Jason of her decision and said,
"I will lead this mission myself."
He nodded, apparently pleased. "I also want to be there."
"With the Anakin Solo?"
"Yes."
"Good. Consider it authorized."
As he emerged from the Senate building, Jason felt a familiar presence. He did not react visibly as the tall woman wrapped in anonymous garments, her lower face shrouded by a scarf, fell into step beside him. "How are you?" he asked.
"Well," Lumaya answered, "fully healed."
"Interested in going on an expedition?"
"I sense that you are moving into a troubled period, into much danger. That's why I came."
"I'll take that as a yes." Jason changed the subject. "Any news of Ben?"
"No. His monitors have temporarily lost track of him."
A note of worry entered her voice.
"He may not have survived."
"I think I would have felt it if he had died."
"Perhaps not, where he is."
Jason didn't ask. "I have faith in him."
"Clearly so," she said.
Zyost.
The last kilometer of the climb up to the Citadel was comparatively easy. The roadway, made of dressed black stone slabs that were cracked here and there, but otherwise seemed little worn by the passage of time, wheels, or feet, allowed Shaker comparatively quick passage. But the little droid began to slow again, 200 meters from the tumble of rock that apparently marked the Citadel's main entrance, and came to a complete stop 100 meters from it. Ben felt like stopping, too. He shook from cold and hunger. He returned slowly to Shaker's side, noting that the droid's lights were still functioning. He pulled out his datapad.
"What's wrong, little guy?"
"I lack sufficient power to move farther."
Ben thought about sighing, but didn't want to expend the energy.
"How long can you stay awake on the charge you have if you don't move?"
"Perhaps 12 hours.
"All right. Shut down now. I'll wake you up when I found a power source."
It took Ben and Kiara the better part of 4 hours to climb to the top of the rubble heap that blocked the main entrance into the Citadel. From the top, Ben could see the trench-like gap between portions of outer wall that had not fallen and the high, more intact inner wall of the Citadel itself. He could see gray-blue skies and white-capped forests stretching to the horizon. It was all so beautiful that he wanted to stay forever. And it occurred to him that if he killed and ate the little girl, he'd recover his strength swiftly. Maybe he'd even cook her first. But she was looking at him when that thought came, and the way she slowly drew away from him reminded him that the thought was not his own. He forced it away and gave her a little smile, a genuine Ben smile. The stone doors beyond the rock pile were down, and it took far less time to descend into the outermost great chamber of the Citadel. The only lights available to him were little streaks of sunlight entering by windows near the ceiling. They let him see that there were no furnishings left in this chamber, not even moldy, tattered remnants. It had been stripped of goods long ago. All that remained were entryways into black hallways and curved stone staircases going up or down. He desperately wanted to descend. He knew the eyeball-shaped ship was somewhere below, hidden, waiting for him, calling to him. But he had no strength, and he knew that if he were to become the ship's master, he would have to conquer it.
"We'll camp here," he told Kiara.
She looked around dubiously, but said nothing.
Ben slept and dreamed that in the darkest hour of the night, something detached itself from the ceiling far above. It looked like three giant balls, the center one slightly larger and attached to the other two by pivots. A cluster of five legs emerged from each end ball, and they worked together to allow the thing to walk slowly down the wall. In his dream, he said,
"Go away."
"No, this is my home now. Your kind is gone. I shall eat you."
"I'll kill you."
It paused halfway down the wall.
"Give me the little piece of meat. I will leave you alone."
"I'll kill you."
It began its descent again.
"Outside,"
Ben said.
"They're next, hunting me. I couldn't bring myself to eat the first one. Now I wish I had. But you can. Go outside and hunt the next. They'll be close."
The thing stopped again and waited a full minute. Then it changed course, moving toward the top of the rock pile. Rocks tumbled down the pile as it squeezed through the opening. In his dream, Ben thought he heard Nex howling.
"Eat, girl. Grow slow."
The voices faded as Ben awoke. Hurriedly, he glanced around. Kiara, looking pale, her features sharpening from strain and starvation, was still asleep next to him. The ceiling was better illuminated. Around its edges there were many odd shapes. Curved balconies, broken statuary, other forms he couldn't identify. He wondered if any of them might become the thing he had seen in his dream. He prodded Kiara awake.
"Come on, we have work to do."
"Are we going to wake Shaker up?"
"I hope so."
As his last act of preparation, Ben reconnected the tracer's severed antenna leg to its main body, then hung the pouch loop around the dummy he'd constructed. It wasn't much of a dummy, just a carefully built pile of stone with red blankets draped around it. But perhaps it would do. It was situated at a spot where the outer wall still stood and the base of the inner wall was littered with stones that had fallen from the high reaches. The pouch hung from its neck. Kiara following, Ben retreated past the shriveled, frozen neck body they had discovered upon emerging that morning. They found a spot concealed between two courses of dressed stone, and they waited. Time passed. In the stillness, Ben began to hear the voices again.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
"You used to want me to protect her."
Ben had thought his words inaudible, but Kiara spoke up.
"Who are you talking to?"
"No one."
"Eat, girl."
Why were the voices different now? That was a puzzle. And Jason had always said that puzzles should always be solved because then they became information that could be used. He tried to look at the voice's suggestion rationally. It made sense on a purely logical level. If he killed, cooked, and ate Kiara, he would have several days' worth of food.
"Eat, girl. Grow strong."
If he did kill and eat her, he'd never be caught, never be punished. In fact, just about every logical argument Ben could come up with suggested that eating Kiara was the most appropriate action. The plan Ben had just set in motion might not work. It might take days to complete. He could be dead before then. Every logical argument... Ben frowned. But not all arguments had to be logical. Kiara was a little girl, one who had just lost her father, her daddy. Never mind that her daddy seemed to have been a small-time criminal, and the odds supported by files of data Ben had seen on the guard computers were that Kiara would grow up to be a small-time criminal or another type of drain on society. She might grow up to invent a medicine better than Bacta, or to write songs, or to act in holodramas that made things better for people. Or she might have children who did these things, or teach children to do these things. But not if she died now. He wasn't even sure he liked her. They hadn't had energy enough to talk very often on their long walk, but he felt bad for her. He felt protective of her. He felt and it seemed to him that neither thinking nor feeling needed to be the boss of the other. In a Jedi, they should be mixed, partners. He wondered if that was the case with the guards as well. None of that answered the question of why the voices had started by suggesting that he protect Kiara and now insisted that he eat her. But the answer, a possible answer anyway, came to him. They had told him to protect her because that's what he had decided to do, and he hadn't known how. In suggesting that they could get Ben and Kiara off this planet alive, they had made Ben listen to them. He had begun to understand them, and then had begun to think the way they thought. And now, they could suggest different things. They could suggest what they'd wanted all along. He felt a burst of anger, but clamped down on it. He didn't have the energy to be angry right now. He noticed that the voices had grown quiet. And in that quietness, Ben told Kiara the story of a young Force-sensitive slave boy who won a pod race on Tatooine and earned his freedom.
"Did they feed him when he won?"
Kiara asked.
"All he could eat, and even more,"
Ben assured her. Not long afterward, Ben sensed the eye in the sky. He looked up into the clouds and pulled his all-weather cloak even tighter around them.
"Is he there?"
"Yes, he is."
This pilot was not subtle. He sent the TIE fighter into a screaming dive that ended up with the vehicle a mere 20 meters above the ground. Then he had to slow and circle, because Ben's dummy was not visible from the open spaces around the Citadel. He had to climb and then drop into the gap between outer and inner wall. And then he lined his lasers up on Ben's dummy. Now, through the Force, Ben exerted himself against the stones at the top of the inner wall, all along the course of the wall above the starfighter. It was hard going. He felt so tired, and it was almost impossible to focus. But an understanding that this might be the difference between life and death, from cold or starvation or mummification, drove him. And he saw the stones high above begin to rock and then fall free. The TIE fighter fired, and Ben's dummy fell over, the blankets catching on fire. The TIE fighter glided forward slowly on repulsors and was a mere 5 meters from the burning dummy when the first stone, no larger than a human head, hit its hull. To his credit, the pilot reacted instantly, veering away and climbing straight into the thickest portion of falling stone. The rocks had fallen more than 100 meters. Some weighed a quarter ton or more. All had sharp right-angled edges, and some of them hit edge first. The TIE fighter spun wildly out of control, hit the Citadel's inner wall, and bounced off again. The twin ion engines were still firing, but the starfighter was spinning so fast that they merely added to the energy of its spiral. It landed beyond the outer wall, its hull collapsing on impact, and continued to roll, shearing off its solar array wings as it did. It rolled half a kilometer before coming to a stop against the natural rock abutment. Ben told Kiara to climb a tree while he examined the wreckage. When he saw what was left of the pilot, a pale-skinned Chev in a bronze uniform, he was glad he had. It didn't take him long to pry open the hatch into the starfighter's small cargo bay. Its contents had broken free of the cloth webbing that had restrained them, but were otherwise intact. 2 days' worth of rations for a grown man, a medical kit, power packs, a long-range comlink, a self-inflating raft, water purification tablets. He took it all, and scavenged other goods from the Chev's body. Then, as fast as they could manage, he and Kiara ran from the site of the crash and back toward the dubious safety of the Citadel. It didn't occur to Ben to be sorry about the being whose life he had just taken.
Galata System, resort station orbiting Galata 8.
From the distance of several hundred kilometers, Luke watched the activity at the station. He employed passive sensors only, including a holocam utilizing high-grade visual amplification hardware, and knew that Mara, floating less than 100 meters away in her own stealth X, was doing the same. Half a dozen vehicles were docked at the station. The crews inside were presumably effecting repairs and making the antiquated station ready for the ceremony that would soon take place. Luke, Mara, and their fellow pilots, including Corin, Kip, Jaina, and Zek, plus Jag,
finally getting some ship time in Jaina's Stealth X, had scouted out the system pretty thoroughly. There were indeed droid sensor satellites along the standard approaches into the system, but none situated elsewhere, and there were routes to which the sensor array was blind from outside the system to the far side of Galata 8. The Jedi had already led several ships from the Ninth Fleet to orbits within the outer atmosphere of Galata 8. Another vessel they had guided into place was Admiral Nyathal's temporary flagship, the aged but still mighty Mon Calamari cruiser, Galactic Voyager.
Zyost.
Ben and Kiara rested the remainder of the day, and from the top of the rock pile, just inside the Citadel entrance, they watched the shuttle. It descended from the clouds less than 15 minutes after Ben, Kiara, and the revitalized Shaker reached the entrance. It was an old shuttle with fold-up wings and a bronze paint job, and it did not land. It circled the crash site endlessly, then took off for the skies once more. They slept well that night, with Shaker keeping its sensors alert for nocturnal movement. But there was none. In the morning, glow rods attached to new power packs, they went searching. It didn't take long. All Ben had to do was open himself up to the voices. They led him down several levels, to where the corridor floors were coated in ancient muck, to a long side shaft that carried them well away from the Citadel proper. It led them to an unlit circular chamber. Its walls were decorated with 18 niches, each large enough to hold a life-size statue of an average human, but all empty.
"It's gone,"
Kiara said. Ben shook his head. The images in his head were clear. The ship was here.
"Come out,"
he said. He heard laughter. Ben frowned. His instincts and what the voices had whispered to him when he only half understood their words told him that emotion was the key. Nor would kind, soft, welcoming emotion do. He deepened his voice, put some anger into it.
"Come out!"
Had he tried it the day before, when he'd been his weakest from lack of food, he doubtless would have failed. But now there was a rumble in the ground, and a crack appeared in the half-dried muck of the floor. A crack as straight as a laser beam, bisecting the room. The gap widened more quickly at the room's center than toward the edges. There it became circular, and up from it, inadequately illuminated by Ben's glow rod, came a segmented metal arm several meters long, and then the top portions of a vehicle's spherical main body. Its circular central viewport, lit from behind and glowing an unhealthy yellow, seemed to be an eye regarding them. The sphere was some 10 meters in diameter, half of it protruding above floor level. A gap of 3 meters separated the edge of the floor from the nearest portion of vehicle hull. Ben swayed, both from weakness and relief. The vehicle was here. It was real. And if the presence he felt within it, a malevolent set of emotions detectable through the Force, was any indication, it was functional, even after centuries in the ground.
"Open,"
he commanded. After a moment, a vertical line appeared beneath the viewport and lowered as a hatch, its near end just reaching the edge of the floor. Ben bounded across and up into the vehicle. But if he'd anticipated finding a control couch, a pilot's yoke, hyperspace and weapons controls, he was disappointed. The interior, which could have occupied only a fraction of the vehicle's volume, was a single disc-shaped chamber, 4 meters across and 2.5 high. The corridor channel leading to the ramp was the only exit. The walls looked like orange pumice, glowing as though they were thin sheets over molten lava, and the vehicle's interior was very warm. When he got to the center of the disc-shaped chamber, Ben turned around and around, looking for controls, but he found nothing. Ben closed his eyes and tried to get a sense of this place, this vehicle, and he did. For a moment, he saw a red-skinned woman in robes of volcanic hues kneeling, her golden pole arm on the floor beside her. That was it, then. The pilot had to communicate with the vehicle through the Force. Quickly, he knelt where the woman in his vision had been.
"Command."
The voice, male, rich in expectant malice, spoke directly into his mind. Ben looked down the ramp and beckoned for Kiara and Shaker.
Time to go!
The little girl shook her head. The astromech tweeted at her.
Kiara, we have to leave.
I don't want to go in that thing, she wailed. It's gonna eat me.
Ben shot her a reassuring grin.
And if it does?
She took a moment to answer.
He'll jump down its throat, and we'll cut our way out together.
That's right.
Still reluctant, she came forward, tentatively took her first step onto the ramp, and ran up into the room. She flopped down to sit beside him. A moment later, Shaker rolled into place on his other side and locked its wheels.
Close,
Ben commanded, and the ramp lifted. Now was the part he wasn't sure of.
Launch,
he said. For long moments, nothing happened, and Ben wondered how many words he would have to go through before he found the correct command. But apparently intent was enough. Intent and visualizing what he wanted to happen. The light outside the vehicle brightened. Suddenly, blinding white, it reached all the way to the niches in the wall. Ben looked up, seeing only the ceiling above him. Then he closed his eyes again and attempted to see as the vehicle saw. And he did. The ceiling above the vehicle had drawn aside in two pieces, and sunlight shone down into the chamber. The vehicle began to tremble like a wild animal preparing to spring.
Get ready, Ben said. I think it's going to...
The vessel accelerated straight upward, its movement pressing Ben and Kiara down onto the floor.
Gilata system, approaching Gilata 8 orbit.
The greatest reward came from the greatest risks, Jason had said, and Lumaya had agreed with him.
So long as you accurately assess the reward and the risks, she'd added.
And then she had volunteered to accompany him on his expedition to infiltrate the Confederation election ceremony. Setting it up had been easy enough. It had been Galactic Alliance intelligence that had discovered there would be representatives of the Hapes Consortium Heritage Council, the conspiracy that had collaborated with Corellia to kill Tenel Ka, at the meeting. And Admiral Nyathol had been the first to propose the authenticated independence groups, even from worlds most devoted to the Galactic Alliance, might find admission. It hadn't been too much work for Jason to persuade Nyathol that he be the Galactic Alliance agent assigned to attend the meeting. His status as the Jedi with the closest ties to the military ensured him that right. Manipulating things so that Lumaya could accompany him had been trickier. But she admitted to maintaining a number of fully detailed false identities that would withstand scrutiny from either side's intelligence division, and one of them, that of smuggler Sylphinia L., had a registered world of birth that would fit the profile GA intelligence needed. So Jason had arranged for documents for himself and Sylphinia from the Essien government, and now, his features heavily disguised under dark spray-on skin color and a beard, he carried an identicard showing him to be a member of Essien's most violent revolutionary party. Working through Captain Levint and her mysterious contacts, he had been able to wrangle an admission to the ceremony, but not a vote. That was fine. He wasn't there to vote. He was there to note faces, identify traitors, and distract everyone present, perhaps by killing them all, when the battle began. And Lumaya was beside him, acting as a backup in case of trouble. Her scarred features concealed under her expertly applied makeup, she now had dark skin and hair like his. From this shallow depth within the atmosphere of Galata 8, the crews of the Alliance Force had a decent view of the distant space station and the stars beyond. The atmosphere made the stars twinkle just a little and made their view slightly hazy. That was all.
Tight beam transmission from Stealth 1, Nyathol's aide told her on the bridge of the Galactic Voyager. A Hutt-like cruiser arriving, but that's the only capital ship in the last half hour. The rate of major arrivals has dropped nearly to zero. Nyathol, sitting in her multiply articulated swivel command chair, grimaced. The odds were now just the wrong side of even, which would be problematic in a straight-up fight.
Fortunately, the Alliance had the advantage of surprise.
Very well,
she said, her words merely acknowledging that she'd heard her aide's report.
Any major players still missing?
No, ma'am.
Niathal raised her voice so that it could be heard across the entire bridge.
Issue the order to the fleet. All ahead, slow. The outlying vessels are not to jump until they receive a direct command.
Jason and Lumaya separated once inside, the better to acquire information across a broader area. The main chamber of the resort, the dome above recently cleaned to provide an unobstructed view of Galadar 8, was laid out with long tables full of food and drink. Delegates wandered from one to the next, or from one small standing group to the next. There was no urgency or animosity to be seen among them. That was curious. As critical as the election of a Supreme War Commander should be, Jason had anticipated more anxiety and more notoriety among the attendees. So far, he hadn't recognized a single face. Jason accepted a drink from a server, a tall, fair-haired woman in a white gown that looked like it dated to the late Old Republic, but was probably just an in-vogue dress on some backwater world. So, where's the coordinator? He asked, making the question sound innocuous.
I don't know, sir.
Any idea when opening arguments are supposed to begin? The server reached up to tug at her earlobe. Just a nervous gesture, except Jason could feel the lie in the casual nature of her movement.
I don't know that either. Perhaps they've broadcast the schedule to everyone's datapad.
What did you just do? Jason asked. The woman's nervousness increased by a factor of 10 or more.
I answered your quest?
No. He leaned in close, intimidating. When you touched your ear, tell me or I'll be forced to kill you. She looked right and left, as if seeking an avenue of escape or an observer.
Please,
she said.
We're supposed to, if anyone asks questions.
You sent a signal?
Yes.
Jason wheeled and walked quickly back toward the door by which they'd entered the big chamber. Through the force, he reached out to Lumaya, a warning.
Gentle beings.
The voice was so loud, broadcast from on high, that Jason was compelled to look. Toward the center of the great chamber, a hologram was forming, 6 meters high. It showed a male human in a white admiral's uniform. The cut and styling, more suited to the Palpatine-era empire than to modern military forces.
If you'll turn your attention to the sky, you'll witness the forces of the Galactic Alliance emerging from the planet's atmosphere. This will be visible as a series of bright flashes as they begin to hit our mind grid. Closer to us, I'd like to introduce you to a distinguished visitor.
A spotlight from high above blared right into Jason's eyes.
If our specialists are worth what we're paying them, you may raise a glass to Colonel Jason Solo, Galactic Alliance Guard. Some of you Corellians may have lost relatives and friends to this man's many recent activities.
We haven't been introduced, Jason said. The giant hologram nodded.
General Tor Fenir, Supreme Commander of the Confederation Military, at your service.
I thought...
That today would be the day that office was elected?
Fenir shook his head, as if saddened by Jason's credulity.
A deception I thought would be useful in drawing your forces in. And your presence here is another benefit, an unexpected one. I know you're going to attempt to fight your way out, but I must ask, please don't kill the delegates. They're only actors.
Behind Jason came the sound of running feet. The security agents. They, he was sure, were real. Yes, he'd fight his way out, but he had something to do first. He gestured upward toward Galadar 8 and put his whole heart into two thoughts. It's a trap. Mines. It's a trap, Luke shouted into his comlink. He's visualizing mines. I say again, mines.
Acknowledge, Stealth One,
came the voice of the Voyager's comm officer.
Be advised, with that transmission, your position is compromised.
No kidding. Stealth One out. Luke switched his comm board over to squadron frequency.
What now?
Mara asked. We go in, Luke said, and rescue Jason. Every officer on the Galactic Voyager bridge waited for the order to come. The order to take a new heading, to circumnavigate the mind grid ahead of them. That's not what they got.
Continue all ahead slow,
Niathal ordered.
All forward gun positions of all lead vessels open up in a sweep pattern directly forward. Second-tier capital ships and starfighters still in formation drop in behind the capital ships. The order is given for Anakin Solo and all outlying vessels to jump.
There was the briefest delay, and then the bridge crew turned to its new tasks. Galactic Voyager's commander, a Quarren named Squin, edged toward Niathal. His face tentacles were motionless with forced calm, but a question burned in his eyes. Niathal answered it.
If we hadn't gotten Solo's warning, Captain, what would have happened?
We would have advanced into the minefield.
Until?
Until our forward ships began hitting the mines.
And then?
Understanding dawned in the Quarren's expression.
We would have set a new course, a lateral course, into more mines that have been maneuvered into place while we were waiting here.
Niathal nodded.
Mines we couldn't detect because of the thicker atmosphere around and below us. Mines that would continue to close on us. This way we're going to be hammered, but with the fewest number of hammers they currently have to swing against us.
Understood.
Captain Squin edged away again. It's a trap, Leia said. Though Jason's force-based warning had not been intended for her, she could not have missed it. Not a panicky emotion from her own son. She leaned forward in the co-pilot seat of the Falcon, but the only thing visible from the Galater system was its yellow star, straight ahead, distant and tiny. Han, did you hear me?
I did.
Han's face was, for once, a mask of indecision.
We have to go in and get him,
she said. The words hurt. Her anger at Jason's actions had not abated. She didn't trust him. But he was her son. She had to save him. The Tor-Fanir hologram had appeared so close to Alima that she was initially partly within his right leg. She edged away, disappearing into the crowd. Getting to this meeting had been easier for her than for any other infiltrator, she thought. After all, memories of her presence faded from the minds of those she encountered mere minutes after she departed. That, and her Jedi skills, made it child's play for her to bypass guards, eavesdrop on conversations, and never stain the memories of those whose resources they used. Now she hoped she would not be noticed as she made her way from the main hall. She didn't think she would be. Jason Solo was doing too good a job of attracting everyone's attention. He stood alone, a semicircle of security guards from several different forces blocking his path. And as she watched, they opened fire. He leapt above the torrent of blaster shots, igniting his lightsaber as he rose, and came down behind his enemies. He spun, and two of them were suddenly headless. The rest fell back from him, firing as they turned. All Alima had to do was flee from this disaster, join the throngs of actors now moving in panicky retreat toward the shuttle access chambers. Then she felt her quarry. Leia was nearby, sending reassurance through the Force. To Jason. It had to be to Jason. That message certainly wasn't meant for her. But now she couldn't leave. She had to wait to see if Han was with Leia. Veering from her escape path, she made her way to a wall and merged with the shadows there. In the shadow where she was hiding, Alima saw two figures force their way in through the streams of actors trying to escape. They were Luke Skywalker and Mara Jade Skywalker, dressed in black jumpsuits with X-Wing pilot's accoutrements. And Alima nearly passed out from happiness. Luke was here and would see Mara die. Leia was still coming. The universe was about to experience some much-needed balance. She stopped bouncing up and down long enough to find her comlink. She spoke into it. Activate and execute approach 2. On the Duracrud, now floating with all the other arrival craft steered to the holding area by resort security personnel, the nav computer would be loading and implementing a set of simple maneuvers. The Duracrud would move to a position directly above the resort's dome, a few kilometers away, and then begin accelerating.
What are you doing, Dancer?
The voice was cold, amused, familiar, and it froze Alima's guts. She tore her attention away from the fight, where Jason was coping with an ever-growing number of security agents, and looked to the right. The dark-skinned woman who had addressed her did not look familiar, except for her build and her green eyes.
Lumaya,
she said.
I asked you a question.
Alima gave her a one-shouldered shrug.
We are here to kill Mara Jade Skywalker, who is here, and Han Solo, who is coming. And you? I was about to dive in and help Jason.
Do not do that.
Alima shook her head vehemently.
If you rescue him, Luke and Mara will leave, and Leia and Han will not come. They must be here.
Lumaya considered.
Then let's jump in together. Our being here will keep the Skywalkers and Solos from leaving. Don't you think?
We do.
Lumaya reached down and tore a long gap in her gown, freeing her legs to maneuver. She unwrapped the decorative scarf she wore as a belt, revealing the light whip beneath it, and rewrapped the scarf around her lower face and scalp, giving her the aspect of Lumaya so familiar to Alima and others. Then she drew her light whip.
Ready?
Alima brought her lightsaber up.
We are.
She was happier than she had been in a long, long time. Luke and Mara made their approach a merciful one. They landed in the midst of the thickest group of security officers. Luke's lightsaber flashed in a circle, severing five or six blaster barrels, and Mara gestured with the force to sweep aside half a dozen agents. Luke deflected a blaster shot from an opportunistic Corsac woman. Let's go, Jason. Your ride's waiting. Jason struck, cutting a Bothan shooter in two. I don't need your help. Then he looked past Luke, and his expression hardened still more.
Oh, no.
Luke glanced back that way. Han and Leia were entering the main hall at a dead run. And your other ride is here. Then he heard Mara's warning hiss, more through the force than with his ears. And when he turned back again, Lumaya stood before him. As Han and Leia approached, the nature of the battle before them changed in an instant. Abruptly, Luke was drawing and igniting his second lightsaber, the half-length Shoto, and using his primary lightsaber to deflect a weapon that looked oddly like Lumaya's light whip. Han squinted. The wielder was Lumaya, though her skin was dark. He raised his blaster and fired, but Lumaya must have been aware of him. She simply twisted aside, and the bolt caromed off the floor, then passed through the chest of the 6-meter hologram of an admiral that dominated the center of the room. Mara, nearly surrounded by security agents, was batting their blaster fire back at them with her own lightsaber. Leia angled away from her toward Luke, and then let out a surprised cry as a low table slid into her path, too suddenly for her to vault or sidestep. She tripped, but came up on her feet and lit her lightsaber. She stopped abruptly and stared to the left. Han followed her gaze to see Alima Rar emerging from the wall-side shadows, an odd smile on her lips, her lit lightsaber in her hand. Mine, Leia said, and leapt forward. Han ignored her. He fired at the Twi'lek, but Alima casually caught the bolt with her lightsaber, then began spinning her blade in a defensive pattern as Leia reached her. I guess this settles the question of whether you're dead or not, Luke said. He caught another crack of the light whip on his long blade, darted in close, slashed at Lumaya with the Shoto. But with an exertion through the force, she lifted a severed human head into the path of the blow, and Luke's attack sent the head spinning through the air. It landed on a table stacked with food.
Of course, Lumaya said. I thought you knew. I am dead. I have been for decades.
Then lie down and let us throw dirt on top of you. With a similar telekinetic exertion, Luke whipped the tablecloth from beneath all the platters and hurled it at Lumaya. It swept upon her from behind, but she cracked her whip backward, cutting the tablecloth in two, then continued the maneuver into a forward stroke. Luke deflected separate light whip tendrils with his two blades.
You really do hate me, don't you?
Lumaya asked. You've given me plenty of reasons to. But no, I don't reciprocate your hate. Luke leapt over another sweep of tendrils, coming down atop a chair, and leaping free